and welcome everybody to episode 32 of Agency Phonics, and it's the first episode of our second year. And today's guest is none other than the infamous, no, not infamous, that's the wrong word, the famous Tiffany St. James. And we'll go into more about who she is and what she does in a minute. But before I start, I just want to say a few thank yous, as always. First of all, thank you to our brand new sponsors, Forecast. Forecast is a market-leading project management software, as far as I'm concerned, because I've seen so many people switch to it over the last 3 months. I've had lots of very, very positive feedback about the platform and seen some wonderful case studies on how it's helped agencies. Obviously, you know, I'm super excited by them supporting us, because, you know, this Pete and I, all of the vodcasts that we run, the book and everything is run as a not for, and our community agency, Nomics, is all run as a not for profit. And so the extra sponsorship can help us keep funding all of this stuff, which is really, really appreciated. So thank you to everyone at Forecast for all your support, and go check them out. We'll put a link to their platform in the show notes. And in fact, I'm going to be bringing on a guest soon who is a project manager, because we haven't really talked much about project management so far. And it's going to be great, because for a change you're going to do more talking than me, because you know far more about that stuff than I do.
Project management. Maybe project manage that episode as well.
Yeah, you could project manage that episode as well. So so we will be going into more detail around project management and platforms and tools and things like that, which will be really exciting, and a little bit of a break from some of the normal conversations we have. Second of all, thank you to Warhive. As always, they support all these shows. They provide us with a studio. We're not in the studio again today, but we were in there very recently, and we will be getting back into it again. But the technology to live stream is all provided by them, and so we're very grateful for their support. Please check out Wirehive and connect to the guys there if you can. They are a superb, wonderful business, and again, we're very grateful for their support. And lastly, just want to thank the team at Cactus, really, and just thank Abby behind the scenes for organizing all of the guests, and Caitlin, who is our producer in the house, who's basically making sure that the shows work. And every time there's a technical problem, which there inevitably is on these things, we're slowly finding a way to keep learning lessons and keep evolving forwards, which is always good. So, thank you to everyone behind the scenes as well, has been helping us out with the vodcast show. So let's get into the thick of things. Now, I first heard the name Tiffany St. James in about 2008. And I was appointed to the board of the Marketing Agencies Association, and they kept talking about this Tiffany St. James. That was the first time I heard about you, Tiff. And she was providing some training into agencies. And I think at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a time when all the big agencies had kind of weren't doing social media, 2008. It was like the next big thing. And I think you were training them all on social media, correct?
That's absolutely right.
But we didn't really meet each other, I don't think, through that. Like, we might have crossed each other in Scott Knox's office. But actually, what I do remember is a few years later, I was on the board of BIMA, the British Interactive Media Association, which is a trade body, again, maybe slightly more tech-focused and more agencies around technology-focused. And you and I, we met after a board meeting, I think properly in a pub over a drink, and we kind of had a proper chat, didn't we? And that feels like that was about 8 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
But what has been very weird is that before then, or during that time, what I realized is that, like, you're one degree of separation away from so many people that I know. Like, now you are the connection. But, like I say, before that, like, we had so many people in common, and it seemed like all of the circles that you hung around in were all very kind of cool, successful people. And so I'm really pleased that you've finally come into our lives, Pete and R's lives, and we've started to actually work more with you. So now I've had my little teasing entrance to the episode. Let's do you want to talk briefly explain to everyone what is it you do? Because you're kind of a serial entrepreneur. You've got your fingers in lots of pies, but it may be better coming from you rather than me going through and listing out your list of accreditations.
How lovely of you. Thank you so much. I'm really delighted to be on the podcast today. So thank you. Thank you, Spencer. Thank you, Pete. I'll tell you what I do now, and I'm sure we'll get into how I got here, if you like. But I work across three separate businesses, of which I'm founder or managing partner in all of them, and then a separate brand too. So, you know, my main business day to day is Transmute. I'm a digital strategic consultancy, and I help large business and governments, UK government and other governments around the world, embed better digital capability. So for me, it's people, process and technology. And actually, as a boutique consultancy, really, I get involved in the people and the process much heavier than the tech, because they want IBM for the tech, or they want another big tech provider. That's the plumbing. I know all of the providers and I tell them who they should be working with. But essentially, for me, the people, the process, the culture of digital transformation is really key. So that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years, and then consulting for the last 18 in different hats and guises. And I can come on to that. The second is managing partner of Cactus Training, like working with yourselves and putting together all of the brilliant knowledge that you have, and working through the pedagogy that I know about how to break up online learning, the best facilities to do that, to activate learning in online training, and putting that together.
And you're very good at that, by the way.
Thank you very much. and the third is Curate 42, which really was to help live events use digital and data much better. So we found that live events weren't using content monetization, weren't building digital engagement and communities, weren't mapping events to business objectives. And we were born from that. And then, of course, COVID hit. So basically all of our clients have said, actually, we just need a virtual event. So we work at the end of the market, which isn't like have a Zoom call, because there's plenty of people who do that and people can do that themselves. But really to get the interaction engagement, brand engagement, online engagement in currently in online or hybrid events. Hybrid is where you've got a close set of small people, or actually we're working with Jersey at the moment and they can mingle and we're not allowed to. So build a studio over there and pull it into a live set where other players are online. So that sounds,
I mean, for me, I'm really excited. I mean, so there's three key things then, right? So first of all, we've got, we'll talk a little bit about consultancy, because when we sort of really kicked off talking to each other that night after the evening in the bar after the Beamer board meeting, or the Beamer event, I think it was Beamer board meeting, I'd like to talk to you a bit more, because I think at that stage you know, I was picking your brains a bit about consultancy, and we were sort of sharing stories with each other. But I'd like to talk a little bit about consultancy with you, and also understand a bit more. I mean, I guess it's the thing about consultancy is it's selling value, not time. So maybe we can touch a little bit on there. Second of all, it'd be great to talk to you about training and the impact that training can have. I'm a great believer that all agencies should provide training to their clients, because it adds value, it demonstrates knowledge, but also it can create opportunities. Pete and I have a 30-point marketing plan which we give to our clients to help generate leads, and one of those 30 points is training. So I want to talk to you about that. And then lastly, I think it's really, really timely actually that you're in this space, because I'm kind of with you. I didn't really say this out loud, but I felt the events industry needed transformation. I felt like many other agencies have transformed, like the website agencies have become digital transformation agencies, you know, the marketing agencies become, you know, most big agencies are now digital first. But you'd never hear an event business say we're a digital first event business. And actually COVID has accelerated that. So, and I know you've been doing some really exciting stuff around holograms. So I really want to get into that as well and talk to that. So I think we've got three sections here.
Great.
Does that sound like a plan to talk?
Yeah, that sounds like a great plan.
Amazing. And Pete and I, in particular, we're a little bit buzzing today, although Pete, actually, maybe he looks a little bit shattered, because actually both of us did our first real-life event yesterday. In fact, it's probably only the second time I've left my house for business in 7 months, and we hosted our first mastermind group, and it was we had 17 agencies, and we're going on a 2-year journey with them all. And but it was so exciting to be back with real people in real life. And I mean, it was ridiculous because we had this 2 meter social distancing rule. So literally we had the whole ballroom, because a ballroom for like a conference room to hold 17 people. You know, like you could probably have fit us all in a room, maybe a 16th of the size of this room normally, but because of social distancing. But they did it fantastically well. And it did make me think that I think the events business has, I know it's been getting a little bit of a tough time at the moment. I know there's been a lot of press about it, and I don't want to get too political about it all, but it certainly felt to me yesterday like there are some very clever things that we could all do to make these things better. So it's quite topical. I think we should be talking about that. So let's talk about consultancy. So I remember when we first met, I think I was sort of raving about a big book by Alan Weiss. Do you remember? It was called The Consulting Bible. And
yes,
Pete and I first started Cactus. It was actually a mutual friend, Tom Bull, who said to me, and in fact, he did remind me this years later, and I did have to give him some credit for it. He said to me, he said, if you're going to do a consultancy business, read, you know, the consultancy, what was it called? Consultancy Bible. Is that right? The Consulting Bible.
He's done two. They're quite similar. One is Seven Figure Consulting Guide, and the other one's The Consultancy Bible.
Yeah, and I bought that book, and it's horrific. Like, the book is like the Encyclopedia Britannica. Like, it was like that big, right? It was, I don't know how people could see that on screen. On the podcast, they won't know. I'm holding my hands very widely apart. And so...
I can grab it.
Yeah, got it. Oh, brilliant. And it was a really good book, but I read it. And it's funny because I had, obviously, the agency, Pete and I worked in Blue Heller for many years. And we got to a point where we started to sell, you know, a high day rate of £1,200 a day. I think we, you know, for 2008, 2009, 2010, you'd probably agree that's a pretty good day rate to be getting in an agency. But we have made that shift from selling slowly, from selling sort of day rates, to selling it more in a more value perspective. But when I read that book, it really helped me kind of, I guess, the beginning of the journey of understanding how to sell value, not time. And so I think we had a good chat that day, and we both sort of talked things through about our approach. And sorry, do you know what? I've turned notifications off and they've just popped up. And apparently I've just, so I'm going to have to just turn this on. Not that you'll be seeing this on the screen, but I'm just going to get constantly notifications. Apparently we're on the Four Seasons website, Pete, I've just been told. Sorry, digress a little bit. So talk to me about your consulting practice today, because not only have you actually got a consulting practice, but you do what we do with Agency Nomics. Like, we have a community of agency founders, and we've got 800 founders now in our community, and you've got a similar, or you're just starting and launching something for consultants. Maybe, yes. Pete, you should probably join that.
Pete's in it already.
Yeah. Invite. Okay.
It's on Facebook, Spencer.
That's the problem when you leave Facebook.
I only stayed on Facebook to stay in Tiff's group.
Some people have joined Facebook for the first time to join my group, which I'm just uniquely flattered by, which I think is great.
Join it again, aren't I?
But I know. I'm going to do something off platform so that people who don't like that particular platform can join in as well, of course. I'll talk a bit about consultancy. I think it's useful just to do a little bit of like journey of how I got to be a consultant, and I'll keep that really brief, but I think that will share some of the questions that you asked in terms of what am I doing and how am I doing it, and particularly the kind of value-based piece. So I spent my early career in central government. I spent a decade in central government, and I joined when they had no email, and I left when they had open data. So it was the real decade that there was, you know, we arrived, there was a telephone, there were no terminals on the desk, there was no email, there were no PCs, you had an archive and a telephone and get on with it, right? And left when I launched data.gov.uk, the open government platform. So it was the fastest, I think, kind of transformation from no digital to lots of digital or early digital in central government. And I was a consultant. I was a long-term consultant. I always had to find a piece of work, pitch it in, work for a different department. So it wasn't just serial contracting with one client. And it really, really kind of cut my teeth. I was a marketeer beforehand. So I think people approach through technology or through understanding audiences. And essentially, there weren't any digital degrees when I did mine. I did a marketing degree. So I spent a decade in early digital government transformation. So it was putting government information on the web for the first time. And then it grew like too much. There were not enough rules around it. Things were obsolete. So I became first part of the project team, the first comms director of DirectGov. So it was the precursor to Gov.UK. So it's the very first time we had a super brand and we put all government information in one brand because audience research told us people don't care which department it's from or when the department changes its name, they can't find it. They just want the information. So we did very early user research just in its architecture and its structure to be able to get to that super site. And the reason I had a hand in getting your MOT online for the first time, so people are still really happy with that service.
Wow.
But I also had a hand in the fact that we now work till we're 70, so sorry about that, guys. Okay, so so that was kind of DirectGov, and we had the eyes of the world on us at the time. It was considered the largest web rationalization program in the world. We had other countries visiting us. Saying, how are you doing this? How are you structuring it all in one place? And obviously, it was the precursor to gov.uk, which is, you know, now a more elegant and, you know, refined service. But it was the first kind of leg up that we did on that. I became the first head of social media pan-government. So 22 central government departments, the strategic leading cabinet office, coordinating strategy and policy and practice across all the central government departments. It's fair to say they all had great people working within them, doing good work, but actually the kind of coordination piece. Now, these were in the days when Facebook flew to us in central government, like the head of comms from Palo Alto. We're like, what can we do for you? Please have a government site. Really early stuff, which was really interesting. But of course, we're in the paper all the time because people are saying they're paying these Twitter crats like so many pounds. And isn't that ridiculous? So
love it.
There was no other head of social media for any government in the world. There was like one girl in the back of the BBC I'd call and say,
What year was this? You were doing
2009.
Yeah. So that's kind of like, because the Obama election was, when was that? Because that was kind of around, all of a sudden it was starting to get more momentum within government.
Yes. We tracked that from 2008 to 2010. So he did two good rounds. And we, you know, I know the team in the White House that kind of put that together and, you know, spoke to them in terms of what they were doing. But it's political campaigning. It's different than like civil service in terms of running the show on a day-to-day basis. So I had to write the rules when people said, oh, it's the general elections. We can't do any advertising. We always switch off every communication channel. And I'm like, the Foreign Office are telling people which country is safe to travel to. We're not turning that off, you know, so setting that rules out for the first time. And then in 2010, we built data.gov.uk. So it was it wasn't the first data store. The US had one beforehand, but they wanted it to be the best. They wanted to link the data in a certain way so that people could make applications with the data from public service content. So they gave me Sir Tim Berners-Lee as part of my project team and said, right, you've got 8 weeks to get the best in the world, but we've given you the kind of best in the world to get around it. And there were like eight of us in cabinet office pulling it together.
So he was like your apprentice then?
Well, I'm not really, you know it's going to be the other way around. But and we launched it in the Guardian.
He was quite big on data semantics around that time, I seem to remember. He was into data schemas and stuff like that. Yeah.
But
I heard someone, and I did double check the dates, but I'm sure I heard someone say the other day it was like 91 when you know, he finally completed the work on HTTP protocol. And I was thinking, I started building websites from 93, like 2 years later. And I think how early was I on the internet as well. But yeah, that's pretty pioneering stuff around social media, because it didn't really get much momentum. You know, 2008-09 it was starting, but 2000 sort of 10-11-12 was when it all started to really accelerate, didn't it? So
yeah, I put the social listening in central government, because basically when I was head of social media pan government, swine flu hit. So I got early involved in crisis communication, in social media, in listening to what the public was saying. We had to understand if people were going to riot, if there wasn't enough vaccine. And people were really afraid about what government was listening to. So we published an open feed of everything that we were listening to so that people could see it. And then I put social listening into every government department. And then from that, every year, I've had a social listening activation. The tools change every year. The tools have grown up. The platforms change. The licensing changes. So I built like Havas Media's first lab in conjunction with them to do social listening. I helped the Somerset floods. And then my kind of most recent in digital and social media lead was as the pan government lead for the Grenfell fire response team. So sat in Gold Command, looking at what information we needed to be able to inform the public during that crisis.
Amazing. And I just noticed that it's a bit of a theme now with the vodcasts after Rebecca's one we did last, where she suddenly had these rays of light come through. And now Pete has now been is absorbed in this kind of like, well, it looks like a purple bubble around him and these rays of light.
It took me absolutely ages to set up the lighting this morning, so it looked like that.
Again, it's looking quite magical, a little bit mystical. But,
I've sat in this seat for 6-7 months during the whole of lockdown working here. Now the leaves have come off the trees. The sun just absolutely comes in here, and I'm actually roasting, to be honest.
Well, that makes sense.
You get a nice tan by the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
So the reason I tell you all of that, Spencer, is because like that's where I cut my teeth in consultancy. So I had to do the things that were never been done before. Several times and you know, wanting like being I guess an optimist, being curious and interested, wanting to lead the charge. People say, can you do this? I'm like, oh yes. I can find out a way to be
able quite to a brave thing to do, and be thrown in the deep end with new areas and to do that stuff with government. I mean, was there a lot of bureaucracy, or was it because it was so early, easy for you to just get things done because it was new rather than maybe fully established? And
so there was a lot of bureaucracy. We've had a government for 1,000 years, right? And there's the protocol. People want to speak to you if you're a certain grade back in the day. It's all but much better than that now. But because I was a consultant, I cheekily stepped across a couple of rules. So I would pick up the phone to directors of communications. I would speak to cabinet and be able to kind of skip over that, I think, from my nature to be able to get things done. The other thing is that actually it was really early in some technical. So in cabinet office, for example, we couldn't get out of the firewall to get digital content out as much as we wanted. But actually at the time, there was a central office of innovation, which was like the government's ad agency. And at the time in 2008, 2009, I think it had the largest spend for any ad agency in the whole of the UK. So it took in £360 million worth of business every year, because it was all government recruitment, all public service campaigns across every central government department. And essentially, we worked in the kind of crack digital team within that sort of put £40 million worth of campaigns through us in 1 year and evolved practice really, really quickly. So one of the things that we could do because we were government is we were taking short edits from the front line of servicemen and making videos before YouTube and pushing them out on Army and Navy recruitment. So actually, as digital kind of grew up, we were like, we've got to have bigger pipes. So we dug up the roads, right? Because we could. So if there's an infrastructure issue, we could get things done that no one else could do. I went up and sat with the Scottish government and helped train them a little bit. And they're like, how did you get this happen? I'm like, we dug up the roads. They're like, brilliant. We're going to see if we can.
Because I do remember the Scottish government, they had the Scottish Parliament were streaming very early live, weren't they? A lot of this stuff up there. Because I'm pretty sure one of the guys who used to work for us actually helped set that up initially with Endemol, I think. They were pretty advanced up there. So, in fact, they still are quite advanced. I still see some stuff now in Scottish government and the stuff they're doing around connected cities and stuff and that side of things. So how did you end up doing the government stuff? Because obviously you've got, well, first of all, where's your knighthood or CBE or MBE for services to the internet?
My boss got the OBE for opening government data because he was a career civil servant, led the team. They're not going to give it to a consultant.
but actually, on that note, you are in a lot of league tables.
Yes, that's right.
Whenever I look on LinkedIn, I feel like there's another top, you know, people in technology list, and you're there on it. Do you spend a lot of time getting nominated for these things? Is it quite a lot of?
So I don't spend time getting nominated. I'm really, really fortunate that sometimes people nominate me, which is
great.
I know like agencies do this type of work all the time, and I sit myself as a consultancy rather than agency. Yeah. So I guess last year I got nominated by The Drum, which I'm really delighted by, as the top 25 women that changed British digital industry in the last 25 years, thrilled to have been put on the list of, I guess. And then every year there's a piece of work that I do, which is in what I call global digital capabilities. And the award that I won last year was Most Influential Businesswoman in Global Digital Capabilities by Acquisition International. And it's because actually I've worked in central government recently, helping them develop the digital skills framework. I've worked in industry with, Bima for a number of years on the board. I've worked with kind of Viacom setting their global digital practice in education, and then I've worked with Google for 5 years or so on We Are Squared. So it's that broad industry, government, business kind of academia that I got on that list, and they approached me, which one.
I want to talk about that quickly, because I think that's it's an area that I've not, P and I haven't really covered off before, and I think we do talk about it in the book a little bit. And it's the fact is that when I first came across you, it was because of a trade body. In fact, both times I really came across you, although I knew your name because of Ollie Barrett and sort of the whole kind of Adam Street crowd. And there was kind of that entrepreneurial London group, which you obviously were also friends with. And I was kind of friends with a lot of your friends. And so can you sort of maybe share with everyone the importance and the impact of almost aligning yourselves into sometimes these organizations and what it does for your career, and how has it helped you in particular?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And thank you for asking. So when I was in central government, I didn't believe that all the answers that we had were in the ivory towers of Whitehall. So I was a consultant, and I took strides to evolve a network of digital entrepreneurs to understand the digital industry. So essentially, apart from the day job of being in government every day, like a full-time role and staff and clearance and all the rest of it, I took trouble to go out to Adam Street, which I thought was the club at the time, which was the home of kind of digital entrepreneurs, where a lot of successful entrepreneurs and lots of kind of connected people hung out. I made sure I went to digital dinners, small groups of people where we're convening and talking, they're talking, like the first digital dinner I went to, they're like talking about Ruby on Rails. And I'm like, I had no idea what it was, right? Because I'm not a coder, I'm a strategist. And I was like, I'm outclassed at dinner. So I went to one every single month to make sure that I understood what was going on in industry and all the rest of it. So I formed a kind of digital entrepreneurs network, if you like. What was then quite handy is if we wanted to test anything, if we wanted to kind of get anything going, we had a digital minister at the time who was Tom Watson, had the digital agenda when I was in cabinet office. Yep. And he really opened his doors to the entrepreneurs because he really wanted to understand, the industry and the makeup. And this is pre-Silicon Roundabout, so to be able to bring in those kind of hordes of people and, colleagues and friends of mine ran open hack days in government with public data. So we were having this kind of how government and business work together. So I had a network, and I started networking really late. I mean, I know loads of people in government because I worked there for a decade, but essentially, like, I think it was just after the, just after the birth of my daughter, like 2008, when I came back, I'm like, okay, I need to probably network, get back into the thick of things. So I didn't, join trade associations or anything because I was in government. And then what happened, this is quite interesting. So, in 2010, the coalition government came in and they put in the biggest cuts that we've ever had in central government since the Second World War. And the digital agenda kind of stopped for a little bit while they were just working through all of their new systems and processes and change of government for about a year. Then Mike Bracken came in from the Telegraph and then carried on, started direct at gov.uk and the government digital service. And it all started going again. But basically, my entire career had been in central government, and then there were no tea or biscuits or consultancy left in central government. And I'm like, oh, because that's kind of all I've done, right, for a decade. Yeah. So I went out to my entrepreneurial network peers, and I said, who should I be talking to? Like, I've got this skill set, but actually, I'm not well known because my job as a consultant is to keep your head below the parapet and push the government agenda forward. Like, you weren't allowed as a consultant, you know, really to have that kind of big profile about what was going on. But I was kind of well known in this digital network as the girl from government and getting things done. So it was my peers and my digital peers that said, actually, BIMA, the British Interactive Media Association, is a, you know, great trade association for digital agencies. Why don't you go and speak to the chair, which was Justin Cook at the time? And why don't you have a kind of conversation about getting kind of stuck in there? So Justin said, head of social media government, we've got a event on the Channel 4, come and attend. So I spoke and I gave my opinion because they asked it for me. Channel 4 went, right, come in, help train all of our staff, help with programs of activity. So I think it was when I knew like no one in industry apart from my entrepreneurial set, that really helped kind of shape and change understanding digital agency industry, which I'd been as a commissioner in government. So I'd ran rosters of digital agencies and knew who the players were, but I hadn't really been working within digital agency. So at 2010, I think I had like a couple of weeks notice and they said, love what you've been doing. You've hit every radar, get out. So I'm like, oh, I have to reinvent myself now from a standing jump with very little profile. So I just went for it. I joined BIMA. I got on the BIMA board, voted in by your peers. I started as the head digital trainer for the Marketing Agencies Association that became Marketing Agencies Action Group, which is now the Association of Independent Agencies.
Alliance of Independent Agencies.
Alliance.
I only know that because Pete and I are kind of on the verge of sort of also getting quite heavily involved with them and sort of supporting them financially. So, yeah.
Great. Yeah. So I was the, I guess, head digital trainer for 5 years. So every single thing about how to do Facebook advertising, how to do social media listening, you know, the early days of kind of, you know, pulling apart channels and social media strategy. I trained, they would perhaps bring in agencies, like a group of different agencies, and I'd run their training. But then what would happen is you'd have someone like Iris say, can you come in and do all of our account managers? So, and then they did a diploma every year, which I still lecture on now, which is about integrated marketing, and I do the kind of digital and social media. So I got to know a lot about agency life and agencies and work with it, but from good kind of solid doctrine of some things we did in government were really, really pertinent and interesting. So we learned how to understand what an insight was really before digital, grew as an industry and audiences and really kind of understanding kind of behavioral markers to get people to do something. Because we were the home of behavioral advertising in the Central Office of Information for, 60 years, right?
What's really fascinating is that when you've drawn into, like, you've spoken to Justin Cook, and I also was a victim of one of Justin's phone calls. Come on, join the boards. And as you say, voted in by your peers. But actually, I'd known Justin for a few years before then, and, massive fan of everything he achieved and his success and the continued success he has now. But when you go to, like, for example, when you talk about the MAA, how it was originally, and you talked about Irish, and you've got, basically, Ian Milner, who's chairman of Iris, who was the chairman of the MAA after Gary Bryan, who was the guy who bought my business, Gyro. And what you find is that you get almost this kind of, with the trade boys, a lot of time is that, the super connectors and the people that are quite ambitious kind of get drawn towards them. And so when you're part of it, your network definitely becomes much stronger, much more in depth, doesn't it? I mean, like, the people you're talking about there are, they're not the sort of Joe Bloggs agency owners necessarily. And by the way, some of the best connections you'll get will be those people. But there's a level of kind of, I don't know, gravitational pull, let's call it, of successful people going into trade bodies. They're looking to pay it forward. They're looking to add value back in as well a lot of the time. And it's funny because I look at that 2008 period when I said I first heard your name really come up. The people that I met on the board in those board meetings, at least three quarters of them are kind of reasonably close friends now. And we'll meet up from time to time, and how, you know, their business have gone on to even greater successes. So there is definitely a really, I think there's an important lesson there you're sharing, which is for anyone listening who's involved, you know, in the agency space or any space, really any business spaces, find your trade bodies, you know, contribute, maybe understand, you know, how much time you're going to give to them. Because the thing about, you know, like Justin, you get asked into BMO. Obviously, you know, Tarek Nazir and you know, is now the chairman of BMO, and with Natalie Gross. Yeah. How can I forget Natalie? It's because I'm doing this show live. Wonderful Natalie, and good friend Nat. And so, and you know, those people are, they get you involved, but then you've also got to be a little bit careful with your time, haven't you? Because you can get sucked in suddenly, just ending up being on little project teams, and you know, gets carried away, and next thing you know, you're spending half your time running the trade body, not the but it is a really important lesson. And it's interesting when I look at the success that you've had, and the and actually just the connections that I've seen you have, and the friendships, you can see how many of those have come from, as you rightly said, almost the Adam Street networking, have come from the trade bodies. It's funny, I can look at your LinkedIn profile, look at who we have in common, and I could probably say how I know where you've almost been to a certain degree. So it's really good advice. And I mean, you must have had some good benefits from it, because I know you have got some incredibly great entrepreneurial friends as a result, right?
That's absolutely right. And I think it's twofold, really. So one of the things that, you know, I've done is be part of a mastermind group. And you mentioned your mastermind earlier. So we are a group of seven of us who've been meeting up for over 7 years. Yeah, normally when we started, seven weeks apart. We're people now who are different disciplines from each other, but actually really powerfully help each other. We really care about each other's, you know, journey. And it might be, you know, financial, it might be, you know, your life decisions. And I think that network enables you to find the right type of people. They weren't just formed as a fully formed group. We had this idea for a group, and it came together, and there was a few core people, and then a few more people joined, and it stuck then as our kind of core group of seven. So I think that in the opportunities of understanding where you can get the help, it's like, form your peer group, form your own mini mastermind group. When I had to launch Have Us Media's social media listening lab, there wasn't one really in the UK. Gatorade had just started in the States, Mission Control, big fanfare over here. B. Bonenbaugh brought it over and said, this is what we're doing. Every agency was worth their salt. Well, we want one of those. And I helped, you know, advise Have Us on how to structure it. Nothing like this had been done. The roles didn't even exist as a social media manager in a lab environment. So I created my own board, and that was to be able to pull people together from my network to help advise on a way that I would never be able to hire them in their day rate, right? They would never want to work for my company, but they worked to solve a societal problem that didn't exist, to be kind of first with that, and then to be connected with each other. So we had like Ben Hammersley from Wired. You know, we had Dan, who set up Flickr, then worked as a data strategist in The Guardian. I had someone in the back end of the Foreign Office, you know, communicating blogs over 80 countries, that you can't pay for their time. But actually putting these group of people together to look at that premise, I could have only have done with the network that I had to be able to help that kind of proposition, really.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously it's such a weird environment now, because the reason I'm saying this is because I shared an example of my diary when I had my agency with the mastermind yesterday with one of the members. And I said, this is what my diary used to look like when I ran my agency. And I used to always allocate like maybe Wednesday and Thursday evenings, because you talk about Adam Street. I remember in 2007, 2006, seven, being invited into something called, remember Paul Walsh? He did this thing called Top Cats, and it was the top 50 people in digital in the country at a drinks event. I mean, imagine only 50 people going to a digital drinks event in London.
That was the network I was talking about. So it was Paul Walsh that introduced me to Justin Kirk, and it was the Top Cats dinners that I went to understand what was going on in our industry. So like, there were only 50 of us, and then there was Open Solo, which was like 200.
I didn't even know you. I was in the room too and didn't even know you. So that's funny, isn't it? I do have some good stories about that, which we'll share another time. But I guess the point here is that you could allocate a couple of evenings to go networking, and in COVID world, we can't do that right now. And I guess, are you missing that going out and meeting people at events? Because you've always been quite good at networking and going out. And some people dread it, right? Some people, I mean, I tend to not say, Pete and I use the word socializing, don't repeat now.
Yeah, and I was going to ask a similar question. I mean, have you found a way, because it sounds like you've got, you know, a really strong network and you've used it really successfully over the years. Have you found a way to kind of overcome not being able to meet as much face-to-face recently?
So not entirely, but I'm happy to share with you what I have found that is working. So what I really, really miss is the serendipity of gathering bright minds in a room and having the opportunity to meet someone that you had no idea what they did, but actually you had a really enjoyable conversation. They found out a bit more about you. You found out a bit more about them. It might have been a laugh and a glass of wine. It might be business, but you're not in there for business. You're actually in there for kind of connections and, you know, meeting people and having a bit of fun, right? So that is the thing.
Not to go there for business as such with the mindset of, oh, I must make a sale. It's just to go there and meet people and have interesting conversations. I mean, I totally agree with that.
Absolutely. And I really miss the serendipity of it. I was interviewed about this quite recently, but I found pros and cons of COVID networking, shall we say. So one is the fact that when I started, I did so much online networking and that I realized that I wasn't spending any time with like my proper friends, like people who've known me for 20 years, nothing to do with my industry. Don't really care what I do for a living, right? Because I was doing everything about networking because it was like, oh my God, we're in lockdown. But there's a few things. So if you look at, your agency numbers community, you'll put together, you know, perhaps some informal, you know, let's get together. There'll be one or two people that will be speaking in an informal online networking that I'll think, oh my God, they also do online events. Like, I definitely need to speak to them. Or, oh, I never knew that you could do that. That sounds quite interesting. And then I'll look them up afterwards saying, hey, it was great to be introduced to you. You know, let's have a chat. I'd love to find out more about what you do. And then formal networking is actually much more effective in COVID. You book half an hour with someone through a Zoom call. You spend 15 minutes, you know, and this is Nathan Lomax really good at this in your community. Here is, what do you do? Who do you do it for? What are you looking for? What are your challenges? What's going to help you? Right, great. Okay, me, I do this. This is what I'm looking for. You know, this is what I do. And then here's a couple of people I'm going to connect you with. So that is really, really formulaic, but pretty powerful, because if you were in a bar for half an hour, people would interrupt you, right?
After the third glass of wine, you're like, who is that guy?
Do you think it's better now, Tiff? Because I think, I mean, look, you know, you have, you know, you've got a young daughter, and you know Pete and I both got kids, although they're getting a bit older now, but you know, it's one of the hardest things, I think, for a lot of business owners when they have young families is a lot of times these things have to happen after work or sometimes before work, to be fair. I think actually before COVID, I think a lot of breakfast events were getting more momentum, I would say. But I think it seems more effective and more efficient now, don't you think? Like we don't have to use many evenings. It's, you know, doesn't affect your social life as badly.
Yeah, you can network. And the pros and cons to it is it can be more practical, and you'll get more out of it if you put the effort into it digitally. You don't get the serendipity factor, so you're conscious of that kind of echo chamber. So where do you go and find the chance meetings? So for example, I judge some digital awards, and then after the judging, you listen to people and you think, God, their point of view was really interesting. So then I'll always approach them on LinkedIn and said, love what you had to say in our judging, love to find out more about what you do. So this, I get the serendipity of meeting more people in semi-workplace scenarios. So whether that's, you know, an agency community or whether that's judging digital awards, but it's never totally random. Like you would get perhaps at a drinks party, someone had brought their brother who did something interesting, or their, you know, their sister or their cousin, or you know, or people that are not of your network and not of your industry. And that's the bit that missed. That's what I'm in London for, you know. That's why I want to live in London, that any day of the week there'll be a group of bright minds that I can join physically and really enjoy their company, whether it's a breakfast a friend of mine has put on, whether it's something I'm speaking at myself, whether it's going to a how-to lecture live and bumping into a couple of my community in it, or meeting new people you're sat next to. And therefore, you've got to be more kind of, you know, facilitate your own journey and understand what is going to satisfy you networking wise, and actually for your life and your community as well, what's going to be right.
Yeah, and I love that you say the word serendipity, because that's something that I, you know, I'm very guilty of using a lot. And there is a great interview Pete's just moving around a little bit because I noticed the light was getting a little bit too, like it was fading him out. That's why I was quickly messaging him on chat in case you wanted. I did an interview with Nathan very recently, and I just urge anyone and everyone to listen to it, because I think as much as, you know, Nathan and maybe myself, you know, are more extroverted, and so you might say it's very easy to go around networking and build connections. But I think the reality is, I think the world we live in now suits the introverts and ambiverts massively, because you can have more meaningful conversations, more intimate, and you can build them into your schedule and do a much of volume without having to walk into big scary rooms full of, you know, people who interrupt you all the time with a beer in their hand. And I think it's much more diverse. I think it makes better diversity on networking, Zoom chatting. I think it makes it easier for everyone to connect and speak. And I genuinely feel that's the case. I mean, I think our last drinks event we did, in fact, we scrapped our drinks event, Tiff, our last one, because we literally had two female agency owners turn up, Suzanne Simpson and Alison Coward. And I was like, this is a joke. Like, it was like, you know, 30 men and 2 women. And so we just scrapped it. In fact, we swapped it for a brunch. And it was brilliant. We had much more, you know, diversity across all areas. And we just had, you know, really nice gender split. And it just made for a better event. I mean, it does. You know, there's no question of that. So, but here's my point. The serendipity word, I love that you use that, because I keep having to remind people all the time that it, you know, that serendipity plays an amazing role in, you know, in your new business, in your just the strength of connections that you build. And it's those magical moments, like even for us, you know, we were on the board together, fine, but we just happened to be suddenly, oh, you're Tiff, you're Spencer, we need to talk to each other. Our paths had crossed so many times before, and we did, and we had an instant great connection. And you know, and sometimes it's just the way it goes, right? You go to these events and you just happen to be in the wrong part of the room and not talk to the right person. And other times you can meet someone who's got an abundance of opportunities for you. So I think, it's interesting about the Zoom stuff. How do you create that serendipity still? And I guess you have to put a little bit of work into it and get a bit lucky. And Pete, I can see you now. This is so much. What a better view. Sorry.
Spencer, you compel people to, you know, meet new people, right? And yes. Actually, the layer I want to add in that is meet more unlike people. So actually, it's quite easy to, you know, get perhaps a call with people who are of your industry, who you've seen or you've been connected with. But actually, it's useful and interesting for you to connect with people who have diametrically opposed views to yourself, to understand that point of view. You know, or people who are not of your network, you know, what are people in social anthropology or gardening or, you know, like different things altogether, not just from your industry, that you can have conversations.
And actually, you know, I James Potter, who we're a big fan of, does a lot of LinkedIn training. He said to me, who do you want me to connect you to? And I said, anyone, when you look on LinkedIn, if they're not connected to me, or they're interesting people that are like, they're just in a different world to me, I want you to intro those people. And I think, you know, it's quite difficult these days for me because you know, I've got, my diary is pretty mental all the time. Both Pete and I, you know, we have got quite you know what it's like, right? Because when you're a consultant, you often have these big time blocks all day where you don't have all day to make phone calls. You're all day in a consultancy piece of work. But I agree with you. I think I'm probably guilty of not maybe trying to open up that and expand that even more. I'm probably not as hot bad as we think, but I think Pete and I do try and, you know, get those different opinions. And actually, and you know, it is true, Tiff, because I have spoken to a couple people recently and they've been really out there, but I've really loved the conversations. So maybe it happens more than I realize. So you had this amazing career and you know, in some ways you've seen both sides because you've done consultancy and you've almost then helped the agencies on that side of things. And I guess one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was most agencies that we work with, Pete and I, when they get to, you know, probably about 2.5-3 million, they start to then go, we're just not going to do the let me do for you. We're going to do the let me think and the let me do for you. And they want to charge for the thinking and not give away the value, because so many agencies are guilty of giving away the value, and so many smaller clients just expect you to give them the value for free, right? So that's probably a lot.
Yeah.
So what sort of tips and advice, you know, would you give people who are, you know, are looking to sell more value, you know, from their business? Any sort of high level sort of overview and things you get people thinking about?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And it's something that I do, and I help my, you know, independent consultancies and sure. independent consultants kind of network with, which is, you know, it's talking about kind of value-based pricing, really, or value-based kind of propositions. So there's a couple of things, really. So in some cases, let's be clear, you can't get away from your day rates, right? Even if it's your CEO of your agency and they're, you know, 2-3 grand a day or whatever else they might be, some clients only have a way to evaluate propositions against each other on day rate work. That it's a lot of like government or public sector that are accountable have to do that. But essentially, if that is not the premise and that is not in set, never give day rates on things is the standing principle, and only break that down under extreme pressure. So start from a place of value-based pricing, because what people want to say is, oh, you know, Tiffany, we'll get you to do that. It'll take a day of your time. And how much is that? And, you know, the premise, like Sam Setti, a good friend of mine, says, you're not buying my time, you're renting my experience. Right. And I, you know, I've done 20 years of consultancy to be able to devise your digital marketing tactics flow in 20 minutes. Right. But, it would take someone who hadn't had my experience perhaps 3 days to be able to do that and research it and pull it together. So it's setting out that proposition. There's a couple of things that can help really well with that in terms of value-based pricing. And a lot of it is about your provenance. So the fact that I am awarded, the fact that I have striven to have a public profile, the fact that, it helps having a unique or interesting name, because I'm probably the first couple of pages of Google before you get below that. So people can check me out and know that I've done some good stuff. And I've done it consistently, I guess, for, you know, a decade or more now. So part of that is your kind of personal provenance as your directors or founders, you know, within your agency. Equally within your agency, that's about the awards your agency wins or the provenance of your agency. So there's a part of it in terms of kind of positioning. The other bit is the differentiation. Are you offering something really unique? Okay.
Yeah.
And therefore, they can't compare it like for like. They can't say, oh, actually, is that really hard to do, you know, value-based proposition work if you're doing commoditized work? Because there's a price around commoditized work. But if it's the thinking piece, then it's really easier to pull it across the kind of differentiation. Does anything else like it exist on the market in terms of what you do, what you deliver, and how you think and feel around that? Because if it doesn't, again, there's a case for, you know, what is there? Some agencies or some clients actually take agencies' value-based proposition and look at what is the next best thing on the market that might do this solution or might be able to do this. And actually, what is your next best competitor looking at and charging and putting together? And that's a kind of, you know, piece of research that anyone can do, because it may take the client. The other premise is that I level clients is there's fast, cheap and good, and you can have two of them, right? You can't have all three of them, right? So if they want it done yesterday and they want it done well, it's not cheap, right? Let's be really clear. And, you know, there's provenance in terms of looking at The time-based pricing of things that people want. I mean, there's loads on pricing. There's loads of like behavioral science in pricing that I've been using for years that I'm putting together as well and put it together later with you guys. But the just on that terms of value piece in terms of calling out is provenance, is differentiation, next best alternative. What is the added value that you can add? So one of the things that I go out my way for clients, and I know Spencer and Pete, both of you are really, really generous with how you kind of profile and work with your clients. But I have reach into networks that perhaps other organizations when I'm just working for my consultancy don't have. Like I can get them in the back end of different places that they like unusual organizations and institutions to take up their, you know, information that they perhaps wouldn't have access to. So what have you got within your network, whether it's a leadership network you're part of or your trade associations, your personal community, that you can add massive value for them? Like I put my clients on stages, you know, they want profile if that's part of their objectives that I sit with them. There's always a like a political or personal objective that I manage to tease out with my clients to understand what's really going to make them tick. And generally it's making them look brilliant, whether it's to their peers or whether it's to the public. So how can you help kind of serve that within in what you offer? And all of these add up to that bit, that picture that you can add much more value that is priceless, really, that other organizations can do and gives a really strong, compelling proposition that isn't time-bound and based.
Amazing. I love that. I think, you know, I remember, I think for us, it was in our agency, we sort of started off by, I guess we started to write down all of the things that we kind of do when we used to deliver a piece of work that maybe the clients didn't see. You know, you might go a day's design, but we never went competitive research, insights into design trends, you know, like all of the things that, you know, that we would do to create a piece of work, an output. And I think when you start by actually writing all those things down, you realize all of the value that you add, the experience that you've got, you know, just the little nuances around your approach, even the process you take and visualizing the process and giving it names and, you know, methodologies. And eventually you start to create a big wrapper around what you do. And you realize that actually a lot of that stuff you probably get giving away for free a lot of the time, yeah. Right? You know, so. And then if you wrap it all up and package it right, then as a consultancy sell, it's easier to do that. Because when, you know, for example, when Pete and I sell consultancy, you know, we don't really have a day rate because we don't really sell by the day. Like what we do takes 6 or 7 weeks. And therefore it's, you know, part of that may be a day with us, but actually there's a huge array of extra tools and things that we share. And so I think it's really important that, the agencies go on a journey. And I guess, you know, there's we're gonna work on a training program for this soon, aren't we? So we should which will be really useful for people, I think.
I think
lots of reading on the subject. I'd always urge people, you know.
Absolutely. I think that for if you look at your network in terms of agencies in particular, people who have perhaps a more digital bent than other agencies. What has been very clear over the last, you know, decade or so is the growth of the consultancy part of the business. When I started, I was pretty unique as a digital transformation strategist. So now it's old hat. Nobody wants to even talk digital transformation in certain circles, right? And essentially then a lot of agencies grew up with that and have consultancy arms. And in certain agencies, they actually, the commoditized work just actually really breaks even. And actually where they make, you know, perhaps, you know, larger revenues is within the consultancy. You're shaking your head, Pete. Is that not true? Well,
like, to break even on the commodity stuff is minus feeling.
Yeah. You hear about it, right?
I remember, you know, when the guys that bought us, they were like that. They would make all their money on the thinking and the strategy, and they would give away the execution.
Yeah.
I say give it away. They'd cover their costs on it. But I think, you know, for me, I'd probably wouldn't. I'd try and do both. I'd try and make money on both.
Yeah, exactly. And therefore, the thing that I want to do working with you guys and helping the agencies that are part of, you know, your communities is really kind of codifying that for them in terms of that online learning endeavor and the activation that goes behind it. It's not just listening. We know people don't listen, don't learn from, you know, listening to videos. And what they do is the activation. So how you bring that alive for them, what's their task sheet, what's the way in which that they can put that to. And I think the first thing we'll do together is that value-based pricing piece. There's all kinds of really interesting things in behavioral science. clients are pricing, time-based pricing, that we can wrap around that. But that value-based pricing, I think that I want to do that as swiftly as I can. We're going to do that this year, but later this year.
Yeah, we read the book, Robert Cialdini's book, called Persuasion, which is a follow-up to his first book, Influence. And yeah, there's a very, you know, clever sort of neuroscience, but, you know, and not unethical neuroscience practices either. Just kind of like just some very, you know, almost just some really smart ways to present the way you present your quotes and your numbers and frame things and stuff like that. So I can't believe an hour's gone already. We've flown by on time.
I know, right? It's really interesting.
A couple of things I really wanted. So that transition to selling consultancy, I think is definitely a journey everyone goes on. And I think if people haven't, I think you have to invest in the time to do that. But you're right. The agencies actually delivering training is also another way for them to demonstrate how much the value they can add and what they know. And it's funny, there's a guy called Jim Bowes, an agency called Manifesto. And I think I first met him it feels like it was sort of about 2012, so maybe 8 years ago. And he just started his business. It was the year they started, I met him. And he told me that he was doing training on agile project management, which, you know, was probably the beginning of the kind of accelerated move from waterfall to agile. And he ran training sessions in his agency on how to be a better agile project manager. And of course, when those project managers then left and went and after training and went and took jobs in organizations, well, guess who they went to go and do all the build work? You know, they'd go to him and he could then provide them with the design and build services that they needed for their technology. And I thought that was genius when he did it, when I first saw it. And obviously I saw it work. And as me, I was an observer of these things and someone who looks for patterns. I then came across another agency that did it on marketing, and they train people on how to do better social media. But they were teaching marketing managers how to do social media. And the agency, most people say, well, why are you giving away everything you know? But the reality was that most of the people at the end of the training session would say, I don't have the time to do this myself. Could you do it for me? And so they were creating, so as a way to not only, you know, to build up, I guess, your value and your knowledge, it's also a fantastic way to help you win more business. Because actually, I think Paul Arden, the famous ad guy, said, give away everything you know and more will come back to you, you know. And I think that's a very powerful thing. So the training thing, and also, just to talk about the training, because I think, you know, Pete and I, we tried for about 3 years to do training, and then we met you. And luckily, thanks to you, you're cracking the whip and you're driving it through. And we now have, just, you know, if anyone listening, do check out the Cats Academy. We've started to put some training courses on. We've got lots more coming out. I've got a really great one on how to create a referral business. Is that live yet? It's almost live.
Yeah,
is
it live? Yeah, it's live.
Is it live? Oh, well, if anyone's listening, check out the How to Drive a Referral Business. Most of you listeners regularly know that we know that between 50% and 60% of all agency business comes from referrals. So I decided to put a training program together about how do you be more proactive with your referral driving rather than reactive. So I think those of you who are definitely more introverted or ambiverted agency owners, this is definitely the course for you, because it's more about, you know, creating your business to be more of a referral driven business. So now the final sort of stretch, let's call this, I want to talk to you about is what you're doing on the event stuff, because it's a bit fun for me. And I love that you said about, you know, the event world, you know, needed transformation. I completely agree. I think, you know, when Greta Thunberg went over to Bristol and, you know, just before lockdown, and I think she cosmic ordered all the planes out the sky, because she definitely said, you know, we've got to bring down the planes because that's where all the pollution is. And COVID comes along and all of a sudden, by the way, I'm joking here. My tongue is firmly in my cheek. But basically, it's funny how the planes have come down. And I think a lot of people, I mean, Pete and I, genuinely, we were going to go to South by Southwest in March. And we looked, could we get there by boat? Like, we were thinking about the environment. We're thinking, how could, you know, as a business, we not have such an impact? But all these events all around the world, they are having a massive impact on the carbon footprint, because they're driving. I mean, do really, you know, tens of thousands of people need to fly to another country to go to an event? And then tell me about, can you tell me about this stuff you're doing with the hologram stuff yet? Is it, yeah?
Yeah.
It's just amazing. Yeah. So share that, because that for me is the future.
I'll take on a little journey with it, and I'll show that in just a second, because some of it comes back to the serendipity before. So what we've seen in COVID in events, as I said, we were Curate 42. We started because actually there wasn't a good enough digital and data play and understanding kind of better relationships within the live event industry. So, you know, working with a friend of mine and a friend of yours, I'm sure you know, Wyndham Lewis, and we kind of threw this around and working with Charles Boyd. Now, Charles has got a footprint in hospitality. He runs 8 Northumberland Avenue and Boyd's Brasserie, which is one of the it's London's most central venue because it's right just on top of Trafalgar Square. But essentially, it's been known as kind of the practice of good digital events for a long time. So they launched in their venue. Charles launched in his venue the launch of the Electric Formula One. All right. And what this meant is a 20 city link up because it was cheaper for Formula One to actually have a holographic Formula One car in 20 buildings than ship it around 20 buildings to do a live launch. So they've got a facility installed in the building called Musion, Musion 3D. And it's the only holographic rig in the UK that uses this particular kind of technology. And holographs for me, before I kind of, you know, we're talking about the business, and I'll come into some of the other things that we do with it, is essentially, I thought, like a Holly from Red Dwarf, like holograms that you can kind of see through that you see in films. No, this technology is like
Star Trek a little bit, like the holodeck. You know, Einstein pops up and they get conversations with him or something.
Wow, better than that. So what we really realized, and I'll come on to how we're using it in just a second, but how we're really looking at the premise of events at the moment. So you've got everyone who's saying, I've got a live event, and they're running it on Zoom. People are bored to death with like all the little squares of all of our faces all of the time. There's middleware, so there's platforms, licensed platforms that people buy or rent that have got networking rooms and other meeting rooms, like a second stream. And the networking is what I call chat roulette. from back in the day. So you say you're okay and matched really quickly with people that have also said it's okay to network, and it's speed networking. And it's some interactive facility and the platforms have that. But actually they're still really streaming like Zoom perhaps into the platform. So the quality of the camera work is not that great. And that's not good enough for some clients, right? So sometimes we can take the middleware license and we use production crews to do spotlighting, bringing out different people that are speaking differently and streaming it all professionally. But the really interesting end of it is we're called Curate 42 because we curate everything. 42 is life and the universe and everything. And we don't own any tech.
My Tesla car's called 42 for that reason.
Yeah, absolutely. We look at all the technology in the market and understand it and plug and play what's best for our clients. So if you're out there and you've got some crazy event technology you want us to know about, you know, obviously do get in touch. Yeah. So we understand what's happening in the tech market and we understand what people are needing in the event market and actually matching those together for experiences. So some tools we're using at the moment is audio visual spatial networking. Now this addresses the serendipity factor that we don't have. So we've got technology where you have a conference, and in the networking break you're popped into a room, 50 people say in your room, and you put your camera on and you can mingle. So you can say, oh, Pete's over there, click Pete's name and just port by him, and only when you're next to Pete can you hear him in the room, right? Wow. Other people can come and join you and you can hear them and see them and speak to them. But if you move away from them, you can't. And then you can say, what's happening over there? And then exhibitors in that room can have a showcase, have a video, you know, host some content and digital information in that room. And we're providing rooms and rooms of these for conference and exhibitors. So that's taking on like one stretch.
Does it need really good connectivity to do that?
Well, lots of people are using it from their place of location, which is home. Yeah. So some things, if you are a speaker or a presenter, what our tech production teams do is remotely test your camera, your laptop broadband, maybe give you a Cat7 cable to plug straight into the LAN, not be on Wi-Fi, so that you can keep up your own home setup. The other thing they can do is then record directly for your computer. Or send you an entire remote kit. So we've got remote kits going out to America and around the UK to stream keynote speakers from actually a better grade kit than they currently have.
And you don't have to do that to the venue in Northumberland Avenue, or can you do it to any venue
So for the example, technology that I'm talking about is any any venue to any venue. The holography I'll come on to talk about next.
Yeah. Okay. So if we wanted to do stuff like from where we, when we do our mastermind groups, you want to beam in a speaker from America.
Yeah. Anywhere.
Yeah. And how does that visually represent itself?
So essentially, it's using kind of TV and live streaming technology rather than AV technology. So, for example, if we had a panel, one of the things that we can do is ship you all branded backgrounds, and then our TV crew can cut them together so it looks like you're on the same stage, or you've literally got the same branding in the background, not perhaps your homes. And then when you're talking, Spencer, that instead of four squares all the same, they manually allow your picture to be, you know, bigger and other people spread around, and then can do that kind of live interaction and dialogue that makes a better viewing and participative experience. You can have polling questions and, you know, all the rest of it that some other platforms obviously have as well. So that is making interactive events better. Okay. We know that people want to go and elk someone with a glass of wine, but now we've got the technology to mingle, which we didn't have before, which people are really excited and interested by, particularly sponsors. There's huge value for events in that sponsorship play.
You can see it though. Sometimes you look at people's cameras and they've just spent a lot more time and effort. And it's clear that, you know, if you've got a really cool fisheye lens camera and you've got, you know, the certain right lighting and everything. And I think more people at home are realizing that. I mean, I've done is buy this very dodgy Yeti microphone. I can see that professionalism around that is definitely, I don't know if it was you, but someone told me the story about how they got this. You probably do this stuff, but you send a whole box almost full of all the equipment to help set up to make it much more personalized.
In the production crews we work with, they will do onboarding first, so they would do a half an hour call with you to help you set up the technology so that it's perfect, so that the later call is when they can live stream you or re-record you or pre-record you for it. So that's amazing. Making things a bit more engaging and interactive and the way that we do it.
If someone had a pitch on, could you help them then think about the way they were going to present that as a team as well, maybe?
Yes, I could. But actually, as an organisation for us, the higher end of the market where you've got a conference budget is going to be fortuitous for us than perhaps helping an agency with the pitch. But we can do it, obviously. But
it's funny because I saw one of my clients moaning because he had to pay £1,800 to go to an event that was virtual. And he was like, surely the whole point of virtual is to bring down the cost of these events, not make them expensive. But then, of course, I'm wondering, are they probably investing heavily in that experience to make it better? I hope they are for that price.
And putting on a interactive or a hybrid event is where people are online and a closed small set is as expensive as a physical event, because you've still got venue hire on the set. You've got a live camera crew recording them, and then you've got a warehouse of your online tech team running the online show and taking the feeds in. Purely online events are slightly less, because you don't have the venue hire. But if you put all the interactivity, as in sending the kits out and bringing them back, cleaning up feeds and, you know, doing all of that onboarding, you know, it's not as, you know, people go, oh, we can just run it on Zoom. Well, I can, but it'd look rubbish, you know, in terms of that. So there is cost and investment. But for sponsors, one of the things that we can do is when we GDPR compliant, ask people, do you want your information to give them the sponsors? Get everyone to tick everything off as they come in, right? But essentially, we can see who watched your VT, who watched it live, who watched it on pre-record, who went back during the day and watched it. How did they watch it for? Who downloaded your brochure? Then we give that export file that can be uploaded to your CRM, your Salesforce. So your marketing after the event is not, hey, did you see our content? It's, hey, Joe, you know, I know that you really enjoyed this, and this, but actually you missed this clip. Have this. And it's really super targeted marketing for high-end events and individuals. So it works harder.
So tell me about the hologram stuff then, because that's for me the bit I'm just getting excited about.
Yeah, so I'm about to...
speakers from estates not have to fly them in, beam them in to a venue, but you have to use your venue to do that, right?
So I'll explain how it works if you like.
Tell us how it works.
Absolutely. So I'm going in later this afternoon into 8 Northumberland Avenue, where we have the Musion technology set up within the room. And essentially tomorrow we are having a holographic experience where Dan Olson is playing on stage, famous music writer and keyboard player, and he's duetting a live hologram in another studio in the UK. So it's almost like two halves of a clamshell. So it can be built anywhere. We just happen to have a 4K feed, 4K LED, and half the rig built within 8 Northumberland Avenue. So it's very easy to us to get the technology and plug it into the venue. All right. So that's the half of the clamshell that's there. And it means this other half is basically the way in which people are recorded. As a holograph, you have to be lit from behind to get the whole 3D event and on super, super black material. But actually, any camera crew anywhere in the world could go to the States, from our commission, not from our company, but you can say this is the way in which they need to be recorded, and can record the CEO of anyone anywhere in the world. And they are not just beamed alive onto your stage, but it's a two-way holograph where you can see and interact with each other. But you can't see through them. It looks like you, right?
Wow, that's so cool.
So there's
Is it a 360 stage or not?
It's a 180 stage in terms of where they sit and cover because of the way in which it's lit.
I can't believe I haven't been there before, but I know Northumberland Avenue. I'm just trying to picture it, but I have to next time I'm in town. I'm definitely going to go and snoop it, or maybe I'll.
It's really interesting juxtaposition because it's a 1,000 standing, 500 seating, probably 250 in COVID seating, Victorian ballroom. And then it's got this incredible tech built in it.
Smart move. The guy that owns that hotel and that venue, very smart move. I think Pete and I would love to do an event there, wouldn't we, Pete? We should definitely do. We should beam in like the best of American speakers or something, from agency world. It'd be great for the UK crowds.
So what we're doing the next 2 weeks, while the rig is built for the Dan Olson event tomorrow night, I've got access to it and I'm taking groups of people in. So if you think that you have a use case for it, then feel free to contact me. I've got the diary and I'm taking people in on tours, group tours, but socially distanced over the next 2 weeks so you can see it in situ. Okay. And you can see it. And then it won't be there. But we're working on the fact that actually, from the interest we generate over the next 2 weeks, it's likely that we'll just build it for an entire month, maybe, February, March, and then people can rent space within it, which I think is a really, really interesting opportunity because it's a cost to set up the rig. But actually people want to do it by pay by view, within that.
Yeah.
The other aspect of it that I think is really interesting for you guys to know about is that PowerPoint and back and front projection has been done to death for a number of years. When you see holographic content, you can be on stage, not just it's yourself or your hologram, but you can have video content running through you. You can Minority Report drop digital information out the way as it drops to you, which gives a real showmanship to things. When we launched the eFormula One, we could spin a full car around in the middle of the audience and lift up pieces like augmented reality to show them, or virtual reality, what was inside it. But as a presenter, normally CEOs, what do? They get to a stage, or any of your clients or any of the kind of keynote speakers, they get to stage and they have a comfort monitor, or if they're lucky enough, they have a glass lectern with projection on it that only they can see in the audience, and they move their heads from there to there. With a holographic rig in the studio, all of the presentation material is eye height and as big and as small as they want it. So they can be almost reading out loud presenting, but it right in front of them. And the way in which it's filmed, you connect eye to eye with a holograph. So they really feel like you're speaking to you. It's like one of those old pictures with the eyes that follow you around the room because of the filming of it. So I just thought I'd share that with you too.
Yes, it's amazing. So, I'm really looking forward to experiencing that. I think it's, got my brain's already exploding with ideas on things that we could do to utilize it. But it's also encouraging that I think that there are some very progressive. I mean, sure, you could beam people on a screen and they could talk, but it needs the innovation to make it more interactive, to make it more of an experience, and to be able to bring in artists as well. There has to be a way. I can hear some really bad feedback all of a sudden. Sorry. I'm just like, it sounds like I'm by the ocean out of nowhere. I'm not sure what's happening. but maybe it's probably my fan on the computer or something that suddenly I just love the way that, you know, because as I said at the very beginning, it feels to me like, you know, a lot of different businesses have had to really reinvent the way they are. And I feel like now it's the time for the event businesses to reinvent the way that they're working. And I know that there's a lot of virtual event platforms that have been creeping in where people can go along and look at exhibitors and things like that. But I think this is a really, really exciting transition, you know, evolution to happen in that world. So it's great you're part of it.
I'm really delighted to be part of it. And, you know, particularly right now for hospitality and musicians to be able to get groups of people together in different studios and then play and duet is a really interesting innovation that's helping, you know, the hospitality and the musicians market. So we're looking at that quite closely. I think it's just a really interesting mechanism, but it's actually not new. I mean, I'll send you some links if it's helpful and that we can include perhaps later in the show notes, but there's two or three executions of this technology I really advise people to go and look at. So if you do Musion 3D Burberry, they used only holographs on stage and then ported the clothes onto them, and people didn't know the models were holographs, but their clothes just appeared. Oh, really? And then the holographs
would you look on YouTube for that? We should definitely share those things.
Musion 3D Burberry show. The other one is Pixie Lott did it a couple of years ago and had five of her on stage singing, right?
Yeah.
She had her own show and she was her own backing singer four times.
Oh, wow, how clever is that? Love that. So listen, that's a wonderful way to finish speaking to you today. I've definitely got some very weird background noise creeping in as well. The show must go on. Hopefully maybe it won't be heard elsewhere, I don't know, by people listening in. But thank you, Tiffany, for all your time. Really great to hear your background. Fantastic for us to hear. You know, I think some really great ideas and get people thinking about shifting from, you know, selling time to value and that consultancy size. We'll put all the details around what you're doing in the show notes. And I just love, you know, that sort of touching on that whole area of the importance of getting involved with trade bodies, the networks it can build you, and also not just trade bodies, but kind of those groups where there's emerging areas happening around new technologies, new areas, but also lastly, just your involvement with sort of the transformation of the event business, which sounds just super exciting. So thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Delighted to be on today. Thanks so much, guys.